Right now, the Israeli regime is the largest cumulative recipient of U.S. foreign aid in the post-World War II era. According to the U.S. Congressional Research Service, Israel has received $146 billion of U.S. taxpayers' money as of November 2020. From 1971 until 2007, the bulk of these funds was fundamental in helping Israel establish a strong economic base. Between 1973 and 1991, $460 million of U.S. funds was allocated to resettling Jews in Israel. Many of these new settlers are now those who occupy the West Bank illegal settlements. Under the guise of charitable donations, tens of millions of dollars are regularly sent to Israel in the form of tax-deductible gifts for Jewish settlements in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, according to the New York Times. Much of the money, falsely promoted as donations for educational and religious purposes, often finds its way to funding and buying houses for illegal settlers, as well as guard dogs, bulletproof vests, rifle scopes, and vehicles to secure illegal Jewish outposts deep in occupied Palestinian areas. Since then, most of the money has been allotted for military purposes, including the security of Israel's illegal settlement enterprise.
It is important for America's national security to ensure that we have a safe and secure Israel, one that can defend itself.
In 2016, the U.S. promised even more aid. Then President Barack Obama signed the biggest military assistance agreement with Israel ever made by the U.S.
Today, we're making another unprecedented commitment to the security of Israel and the Israeli people. Like any discussion between friends, these talks have had their shares of twists and turns. But I think the end result speaks for itself. The Memorandum of Understanding we'll be signing shortly commits to providing Israel $38 billion in military aid over 10 years, including $33 billion in foreign military financing funds and an unprecedented commitment of $5 billion for missile defense. This marks a significant increase over our existing funding, and it will ensure that Israel has the support it needs to defend itself by itself, and to preserve its qualitative military edge. This is the single largest pledge of military assistance to any country in U.S. history.
In December 2016, Israel became the first after the United States to receive the U.S.-built F-35 stealth jet to enhance its Air Force's ability. According to official congressional documents, the U.S. also may approve additional sales of the F-35 fighter jet and accelerate delivery of KC-46A refueling and transport aircraft. Quite often, U.S. money ends up in the Israeli government coffers under false pretenses. For example, the latest stimulus package includes $50 million to fund the Nita M. Lowy Middle East Partnership for Peace Funds, supposedly to provide investments in people-to-people exchanges and economic cooperation between Israelis and Palestinians, with the goal of supporting a negotiated, sustainable two-state solution. Most of this money is not included in the official U.S. aid packages to Israel and therefore receives little scrutiny, let alone media coverage. The mounting death toll from Israel's campaign of airstrikes against Gaza has thrust U.S. military assistance to the regime into the spotlight. A small group of Democrats now call for conditions to be placed on the several billions of dollars Washington gives Israel each year.
I want to read something a mother named Iman in Gaza wrote 2 days ago. She said, quote, "Tonight I put the kids to sleep in our bedroom so that when we die together." And no one would live to mourn the loss of another one. The statement broke me a little more because of my country's policies and funding will deny this mother's right to see children live, her own children live, without fear and to grow old without painful trauma and violence. We must condition aid to Israel on compliance with international human rights and end the apartheid. We must, with no hesitation, demand that our country recognize the unconditional support of Israel has enabled the erasure of Palestinian life and the denial of the rights of millions of refugees.
While unemployment and poverty levels in the U.S. have skyrocketed as a result of repeated lockdowns, Washington still provides Israel with $3.3 billion in military assistance and $500 million for U.S.-Israel missile cooperation.
We have a responsibility to conduct oversight over our government's foreign policy and what happens with the millions of dollars we send in aid. So I would encourage my colleagues to visit, meet with the people we were going to meet with, see the things we were going to see.
Apart from these new voices, support for Israel is considered a bipartisan priority and for decades has been perceived as the most stable item on the U.S. foreign policy agenda. The mere questioning of how Israel uses the funds, whether military aid is being actively used to sustain its illegal occupation of Palestine, finance illegal settlements, fund annexation of Palestinian land, or violate Palestinian human rights is a major taboo.
I ask for the U.S. to stop aiding Israel, because if Israel is getting this power from the U.S., then nothing will change. There will always be violence. There will always be killing. There will always be this continuation of, like you know, just hatred amongst people.
So the next step is on the American government. In my opinion, they're completely complicit with the $3.8 billion in military aid they give to Israel every year. The American government could leverage that aid to have them end the blockade on Gaza immediately.
Despite increasing protests against U.S. aid provided to Israel, Washington still insists on serving as the regime's main benefactor. It's hard to imagine if Israel could afford the heavy economic burden of continuing their occupation of neighboring Arab lands, such as the costs of maintaining the military forces in the territories, the construction of illegal settlements, and the expanded infrastructure to bypass autonomous Palestinian population centers without U.S. financial support. It's even harder to imagine if the regime could survive without generous aid coming straight from American taxpayers' pockets.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. Reports that Denmark's military intelligence agency helped the United States to spy on leading European politicians, including the German Chancellor, Angela Merkel, have sparked concern and demands for an explanation in European Union capitals. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Guardian journalist John Henley. The piece is titled "Denmark helped U.S. spy on Angela Merkel and European allies." reports that Denmark's military intelligence agency helped the United States to spy on leading European politicians, including the German Chancellor Angela Merkel, have sparked concern and demands for an explanation in European Union capitals. Danish public broadcaster Denmark's Radio said the U.S. National Security Agency, NSA, whose alleged tapping of Angela Merkel's phone was disclosed by Edward Snowden in 2013, also used the Danish Defense Intelligence Service, the FE, to spy on officials in Sweden, Norway, and France. The allegations are contained in an internal classified report on the Danish Defense Intelligence Service, FE's role in the Surveillance Partnership Agreement with the U.S. National Security Agency, NSA, from 2012 to 2014, the broadcaster said, citing 9 unidentified sources familiar with the investigation. It said the National Security Agency, NSA, used Danish information cables to spy on senior officials, including the former German Foreign Minister Frank-Walter Steinmeier and the then opposition leader Per Steenbroek. It was not clear whether the Danish government authorized the phone taps. The Danish Defense Minister, Trine Bramsen, who took over the defense portfolio in June of 2019, was reportedly informed of the espionage in August of last year. She told Denmark's Radio that systematic eavesdropping of close allies was clearly unacceptable. France's Europe Minister, Clement Beaune, said the reports were extremely serious if proven true. We need to see if our partners in the European Union, the Danes in particular, have committed errors in their cooperation with American intelligence services, Clement Beaune told French radio. Between allies, there must be trust and a minimal cooperation. Angela Merkel's spokesman, Stefan Siebert, said on Monday, 31st of May, that the German government had taken note of the reporting. It is in contact with all relevant national and international authorities for clarification. The German politician Per Steenbroek, meanwhile, said the U.S. National Security Agency, the NSA, and the Danish Defense Intelligence Service, the FE's activities were a political scandal. The former center-left SPD party leader, Per Steenbroek, said he accepted Western states needed intelligence services, but added it was grotesque that friendly intelligence services are indeed intercepting and spying on top representatives of other countries. Denmark's Radio, the public broadcaster, published the allegations on Sunday evening in a joint investigation with the Swedish public broadcaster SVT, Norway's NRK, France's Le Monde, and Germany's NDR, WDR, and Süddeutsche Zeitung. The Danish broadcaster said the NSA retrieved text messages, calls, and internet traffic, including searches and chats, thanks to its partnership with the Danish Defense Intelligence Service, the FE. Denmark, a close United States ally, hosts several key landing stations for undersea internet cables to and from Sweden, Norway, Germany, the Netherlands, and Britain. Neither the agency or its director at the time, Lars Finsen, have commented on the report. Lars Finsen and 3 other Danish Defense Intelligence Service FE officials were suspended last year by an independent oversight board following criticism and accusations of serious wrongdoings stemming from the internal investigation, which began in 2015, according to Denmark's Radio. The U.S. National Security Agency, the NSA, did not immediately respond to requests for comment. Sweden's Defense Minister, Peter Holtquist, demanded full information, and his counterpart in Norway, Frank Bakke-Jensen, said the allegations are being taken seriously. If confirmed, the spying was happening during and after the 2013 Edward Snowden affair, when the former NSA contractor revealed thousands of secret documents exposing the vast U.S. surveillance operation mounted after the 9/11 attacks in 2001. Edward Snowden, on Sunday, 30th of May, accused U.S. President Joe Biden, who was U.S. Vice President at the time of the spying incident, of being deeply involved the first time around. Edward Snowden called on Twitter for full public disclosure, not only from Denmark, but their senior partner as well. The former contractor has been charged in the United States with theft of government property, unauthorized communication of national defense information, and willful communication of classified communications intelligence, and is currently living in Russia.
To swim in the murky waters of the North Sea, where lie the remnants of 5 centuries of naval battles. I found this submerged world even more fascinating as it was hidden. Through diving, I understood the extent of the military debris left behind by the 20th century. Because in the North Sea and the Baltic Sea, the Allies deliberately sunk ships transporting hundreds of millions of tons of chemical weapons. Today, we are holding more and more commemorations for both world wars, while under the sea, the metallic fuselages holding these substances are corroding. If we don't take action, scientists predict an unprecedented catastrophe.
The munitions are silent killers that are basically the chemical releases from them are drifting in the ocean as we speak today.
Why were these chemical weapons dumped in the sea? What action can we take to protect man and the environment before it's too late? Because this dreadful legacy is ready to resurface as if the salt water was preventing history's scars to heal.
Part 3.
At the start of the 20th century, the North Sea is the confrontation site for the industrial nations. France, the Netherlands, the UK, Belgium, and Germany battle over commercial and political geoeconomics. Europe's first industrial war sees the development of new weapons, like the submarine, the airplane, tanks, and deadly chemical weapons. All North Sea and Baltic coasts are affected, and new sites appear. In the North Sea, over 50 sites are identified. This figure doesn't include many forgotten cases of dumping, so it's impossible to make a precise list of all the dumping sites. In order to help the fishermen, the Royal Danish Navy mission is to decontaminate ships polluted by gas. A bomb disposal unit is permanently ready to intervene in the zone.
On our ChemSea program, the search and assessment of chemical weapons, we investigated the codfish in munition sites and outside munition sites. In the munition sites, we actually found tumors in the codfish, stress on their kidneys and livers, extraprudential fish diseases. But the most alarming thing we found were the juvenile fish, their inability to reproduce. We're actually investigating Bellhorn now. We're taking fish samples, and some of these samples we have found are positive.
So if you expose the mussels to these compounds, they take it up, and they take it up in relation to the concentration you expose them to, and they show even on the lower concentration, on the lowest concentration, they show already effects. There's one thing now to investigate how many or how high the concentration of a compound deriving from a warfare agent is in the organism you intend to consume, for example, so in the flesh of the fish or in the entire muscles. That's one thing, and you can debate about any limits now, which are allowed and which are maybe not really harming the consumer or not. However, there is, for me personally, there's only a general question. Do we accept that there are traces of damned ammunitions made to kill humans in your food?
What we know from the sediments and the water is that in all areas where munitions was dumped, you can find the substances leaking from the corroding munitions in the sediment and also in the deep waters. So there is a risk, really, that marine life takes up the substances in their natural habitat. After having studied this issue now for many years, we consider this to be a real ecological time bomb.
How do you explain that Germany and Belgium, with poor military budgets, have been working on solutions since 1980, while France is doing nothing? Domestic defense has the vast sum of 34.2 billion euros at its disposal, the equivalent of the Russian army, the second military force on the planet. Postponed until later. France has been doing that for over 20 years. Thus, the French chemical weapons were first of all stored in open air in a field in Vimy, in the Pas de Calais, regardless of the minimal security rules of the local population. But accidents, explosions, and leaks of toxic substances put pressure on army ministries to move the ammunition at the discretion of a military site. The shells were moved to the Suippes base in Aube. This camp had already housed part of the nuclear strike force. It was in the Pluton silos of the Hades missiles, as in the gods of hell in Greek mythology, where they were stored. The French army were the only ones not to give me authorization to film, and I couldn't film the camp. But 10 years ago, I'd filmed the same kind of half-buried silos in the north of the U.S., One century after the end of World War I, historic ammunition is rotting in the alveoli of old nuclear sites. It raises questions on the future of ammunition manufactured by the Directorate General of Armaments. Because if France is incapable, for solely political reasons, of taking charge of 100-year-old weapons, what has it done with its obsolete major nuclear arsenal? France's chosen technology to destroy its land-based chemical arsenal will be operated by a dismantling program called Sequoia. Sequoia is not a new witticism from Michel Sapin. It's a military factory under construction in Aube that I was not authorized to film. These refusals emanate from one of France's most opaque structures, the Director General of Armaments. The DGA entrusted construction to an industrial military group that was rapidly sued for insider influence and bribery. The Sequoia project, 20 years after its launch, is still not operational. To put a stop to submerging this ammunition in the sea, the Belgian army built a dismantling center at Poelcapelle, in operation for over 20 years, despite a restricted military budget. Bomb disposal experts deal with shells from Flanders fields daily. The center has a solution for treating the abundant land-based ammunition. Could it take charge of the 35,000 tons of weapons submerged at Naka?
At this moment in Poelcapelle, every day munition, chemical munition from Flanders fields is brought in. What if you come up with thousands, tens of thousands of shells at the same time from the Paardenmarkt site that are corroding all of a sudden very fast because you put them in the air, so there's a lot of oxygen around?
I strongly believe that if we don't clean up the munitions, the ocean will die. It's just a matter of time. What we need to do now is we need to develop an international treaty, an international trust fund to address the site. We can clean this up.
My investigation leads me back to Germany, where it all began. The Munster camp, an epicenter of the German chemical program during World War I and World War II, is located in the heart of a dense forest and still heavily contaminated. In the early 20th century, this camp was pioneering in the design of chemical weapons. Today, it is the European leader in decontamination techniques. The Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons uses German know-how to destroy mustard gas, chlorine, and the sarin gas. Perhaps one day, this center will destroy the ammunition that is submerged close to the German North Sea and Baltic coasts. For the moment, the solutions mostly concern weapons found on the ground. The issue of submerged ammunition and the damage it causes is still pending.
What we need to do is remove this from the military and establish civilian authority boards that can manage a cleanup, manage a solution to doing something about these munitions. As long as the military has them, they will determine, do I buy a tank, a plane, or a ship, or do I clean up a munition site? What do you think the answer is?
Since 1997 in Germany, a public company is responsible for dismantling and decontaminating on behalf of the Federal Ministry of Defense. The metallic residue that survives the destruction of the chemical elements is reduced to scrap and poured into containers. These small pieces of metal will be recycled for undercarriages for children's bikes, or will perhaps be turned back into shells for the tanks that I can hear in training. 10,000 years ago, the North Sea didn't exist, and a vast forest connected France to England. At the end of my filming, I met a Dutch fisherman who pulls out mammoth bones in his net, mixed with shells from both world wars. This discovery made me realize the lifespan of our population, these traces that we leave behind. These fossils came from a time when the North Sea didn't exist, while chemical weapons will probably poison the sea for centuries to come. What will remain of our civilization other than this waste? The sea is a world where everything is murky. Even our past becomes an oversight there. The dumping sites were forgotten willingly or through negligence. Even if oversight represents the biggest danger, today the sea where life came from is threatened by a time bomb that may destroy the fundamental things that populate it.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Members of more than 100 Palestinian, Arab, and Muslim groups joined other critics of the Israeli regime's recent bombardment of Gaza in Washington, D.C. recently to hold a march for Palestine, urging U.S. President Joe Biden and Congress to hold the Israeli regime accountable for its war crimes. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Jessica Corbett Ryder. This article is published under the heading, D.C. March for Palestine Demands Biden and Congress Hold the Israeli Regime Accountable for Its War Crimes in Gaza. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Members of more than 100 Palestinian, Arab, and Muslim groups joined other critics of Israeli regime's recent bombardment of Gaza in Washington, D.C. recently to hold a march for Palestine, urging U.S. President Joe Biden and Congress to hold the Zionist regime accountable for its war crimes in Gaza. We just want the world to recognize that we are human beings, Lamal Ahmad, a march participant, told reporters. Al Ahmad, a 43-year-old stay-at-home mother, is of Palestinian origin but grew up in the UAE. She moved to the U.S. about 2 decades ago and now lives in Virginia. She said that there is a huge change happening in the U.S. now regarding support for Palestinian sovereignty. Over 200 Palestinians, including scores of children, were killed earlier this month as the Zionist regime carried out airstrikes on the besieged Gaza Strip. A ceasefire ended 11 days of the Zionist regime's violence, but calls for consequences have persisted. The United Nations human rights chief said that the Israeli regime's airstrikes, which affected governmental buildings, homes, media offices, medical facilities, and other essential infrastructure, may constitute war crimes. In the past 3 weeks, people from across the world have shown unprecedented solidarity and support for the rights of the Palestinian people, said Dr. Mohsen Ansari, president of the Islamic Circle of North America, ICNA, and United States Council of Muslim Organizations, USCMO chair, in a statement recently. He added, "This unwavering support from just individuals across the globe has sent a clear message to the regimes of Israel and the United States that the atrocities and the killing of innocent civilians, including children, is absolutely unacceptable." The hashtag March 4th Palestine was a part of the new hashtag Sanction Israel campaign, urging the Biden administration and members of Congress to sanction the Zionist regime and stop providing the regime with billions in U.S. tax dollars and military hardware. Millions of Americans around the country are joining to say there must be an end to this ugly, immoral, and illegal status quo. Osama Abu Rashid, executive director of the American Muslim for Palestine, AMP, told Arab News. Organizers of the march, which began at Lincoln Memorial Day, included USCMO, AMP, and various partner organizations, such as the Council on American-Islamic Relations, CAIR. "We are seeing increasing progress in raising awareness for Congress to better support solutions to protect the legal and human rights of Palestinians," CAIR National Executive Director Nihad Awad said in a statement recently. "At the same time, we have witnessed a continued reluctance in the Biden administration to hold Israel accountable for its war crimes in Gaza or uphold American values by demanding an end to evictions of Palestinians in Al-Quds," unquote.
news line.
Israel's war on Gaza ended over a week ago, but voices in condemnation of the regime's crimes against the Palestinian people are still being heard around the world. Pro-Palestinian activists from across the United States descended on the capital, Washington, D.C., to hold a rally. The protesters called on Israel to stop killing Palestinians. They also called for an end to Israel's occupation of Palestinian territories and demanded that the U.S. government stop funding the regime.
For us, we need to demand the following. One, immediate, unconditional lifting of the siege on Gaza. Let me repeat, immediate, unconditional lifting of the siege on Gaza, because that is what international law requires. Second, we need to hold Israel accountable in the International Criminal Court. Netanyahu is a criminal war, committed war crimes. We need to take Israel to the International Criminal Court. Third, we need the implementation of the 4 Geneva Convention. Palestinians should be protected, not demonized.
It's definitely significant. There hasn't been a demonstration. They're not huge demonstrations. It's hundreds of people, but that's better than nothing at all. And it's not just in Washington, it's in New York, in Boston, in Michigan, Dearborn, there are, as you said, in London as well. So the visibility is there where it wasn't before on Palestinian issues. So this is really a change. And also there's now, it's quite acceptable for Congress and Senate to put forward bills to curb the so-called aid, the military gifts of $3 billion every year for Israel to destroy Palestinians.
Other speakers rejected attempts by corporate media to use the manufactured anti-Semitism crisis to undermine public support for the Palestinian cause. Israel's foreign minister, Gabi Ashkenazi, arrived in the Egyptian capital, Cairo, on Sunday to discuss the May 21st truce. It marked the first formal visit by an Israeli foreign minister to Egypt in 13 years. Ashkenazi had earlier said he'd discuss what he called a permanent ceasefire with Egypt's officials. The truce was brokered and is being monitored by Egypt.
Just calling for a permanent ceasefire, it makes you want to laugh, because a ceasefire is a break in hostilities. A permanent ceasefire would be peace. So if what they're calling for is peace, well, then now you're going to have to get into how do you come about peace. You have to negotiate. And who are you going to negotiate with? Well, you have to negotiate with Hamas, because the PA has really no authority here. So the very first thing, before anything, you have to have elections. So somehow Israel's got to allow elections to go ahead. But they won't want to do that, because that will elect Hamas. But in any case, they're going to have to deal with Hamas on the ceasefire, because Hamas is the military power, the only resistance, active resistance. The PA is basically just a caretaker for Israel.
Palestinians have hailed their victory in the battle, citing their show of force to the Israeli regime by launching over 4,000 rockets and scores of drones to combat the enemy. Secretary General of the Islamic Jihad Movement, Ziad al-Nakhala, has said the fight with Israel proved that Palestinians can overcome all challenges with a strong will. Nakhala added that for every Palestinian killed by Israel, the resistance will bomb Tel Aviv. The developments over the past month have shown that the next time the regime ventures an offensive against Gaza, it would face grave consequences.
A mass grave containing the remains of 215 indigenous children has been discovered in Canada. The remains were unearthed at the site of a former residential school for indigenous children near the town of Kamloops in British Columbia. The bodies belonged to students, including some as young as 3 years old. The authorities said an investigation into the timing and cause of their death is underway. The Canadian Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, reacted to the news by calling it distressing and a reminder of a dark chapter in Canada's history. Also, Canada's National Center for Truth and Reconciliation said in a statement that the discovery of bodies of Indigenous children at a former residential school is a reminder of the violence that had been inflicted on Indigenous societies. The Kamloops Indian Residential School was the largest in Canada's residential school system. It was part of a network of schools run by the Roman Catholic Church from the 1870s until 1996. For more than a century, Canadian authorities forcibly assimilated Indigenous children by separating them from their families and forbidding them from speaking their native languages or performing cultural practices. Residential schools' main objective was assimilating the children into white Canadian society by severing their Indigenous family and cultural ties. These were the values that colonial settlers, who made up the majority of the population at that time, brought to Canada. Children were victims of widespread physical, emotional, and sexual abuses within these institutions. Today, those experiences are blamed for a high incidence of poverty, alcoholism, and domestic violence, as well as high suicide rates in their community.
The land that is stolen from them is simply a result. It's not the cause. It is certainly part and parcel of it. The Indigenous population has suffered greatly since the first white Europeans colonists came to Canada. They stole the land, but they oppressed the people. They killed them. They enslaved them. This is a long, long history of settler colonialism that Canada has not yet come completely to terms with, and it needs to.
...150,000 Native or First Nations children were forcibly removed from their families and sent to residential schools. Schools were rife with physical abuse, rape, malnutrition, and other atrocities against the children. A 2015 investigation into Canada's residential school network concluded that the Canadian government and churches have pursued a policy of cultural genocide against the country's rightful owners. The documents revealed that many students lost their lives because they were exposed to outbreaks of measles, tuberculosis, influenza, and other contagious diseases. Over 4,100 children died due to diseases or in accidents at schools have been identified to date. They were often buried in unmarked graves without identification or notice to their parents. Moreover, while the residential schools may be closed, Indigenous children continue to be separated from their families in disproportionate numbers. According to census data, in 2016, more than 52% of children in foster care were Indigenous. That's while Indigenous children made up 7.7% of Canada's all foster children in care population. The systematic discrimination against Indigenous people in Canada has existed for decades. Despite making up just 5% of Canada's population, 30% of the country's prisoners are Indigenous. Also, the government has willfully and recklessly discriminated against Indigenous children living on reserves by failing to provide funding for child and family services.
Yes, their rights will be respected, but it will be because of activists, people within the Native community who are working very hard now. There are many, many people who are working for the rights of Indigenous people, people not only members of that community, but members of other communities within Canada. They're working hard to implement government changes, to make the government see that it must respect their rights.
Forced removal, genocide, and assimilation are what colonial settlers inflicted on the Indigenous peoples in Canada. After all, What's for sure is that Canada's foundation as a country is based upon the process of colonization.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip are still reeling from the most recent Israeli onslaught against the coastal territory. Such scenes of destruction are seen throughout Gaza, with many families camping near their flattened homes. It could take many months before these ruined buildings are rebuilt. Israel's devastating onslaught left scores of Palestinians, including dozens of children, dead. The war was another stark reminder of how brutal the regime can be in dealing with the people it has subjugated for many decades. The Israelis argued during the operation that they were trying to wipe out resistance groups and their capabilities. But that's implausible because the sheer number of civilian casualties and horrific scenes of destruction of residential buildings leave no doubt that the regime committed numerous crimes and violations during its latest war. On Thursday, the United Nations Human Rights Council voted to launch an international investigation into the war. The draft resolution was presented by Pakistan on behalf of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation and the Palestinian delegation to the United Nations. Pakistan's ambassador to the OIC, Khalil Hashmi, who was speaking on behalf of the organization, sharply criticized Israel's supporters. He blasted Israel's allies for shielding the occupier from global accountability and providing arms and ammunition for its widely reported war crimes and crimes of apartheid against the Palestinian people. United Nations Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet had tough words for Israel. She rejected Israeli claims that the destroyed buildings in Gaza were hosting members of the Palestinian resistance groups or used for military purposes. Meanwhile, the UN rights chief also criticized Hamas for firing rockets at Israeli cities, saying it constituted, quote, a clear violation of international humanitarian law. Thursday's announcement of an international investigation into alleged crimes committed during the 11-day war seems to have enraged the Israelis. The regime was quick to reject the decision, saying it would not cooperate with the probe. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas, on the other hand, welcomed the investigation. The United States, which has observer status and no vote at the Geneva Forum, refrained from speaking at the special session. The investigators will have a broad mandate to look into all alleged violations. The probe will cover not just the Gaza Strip, but also the occupied West Bank and the Israeli cities, which came under retaliatory rocket attacks by Palestinian resistance groups. Future findings of the independent investigation are expected to once again mount pressure on the Israeli regime. But will its allies allow any meaningful action against it? The U.S. in particular has been extremely supportive of Tel Aviv. Observers believe this unwavering support leaves no room for the U.S. to want to be a mediator between the Israelis and the Palestinians.
For people in Palestine, for many, many countries in the world, the notion of the United States being a mediator is simply a derisory. It's a joke, and nobody believes it. But for internal domestic consumption, that's important. It also is a fig leaf for Europeans, particularly the British, but others, to say, well, the United States is in charge, and we don't have to do anything. But I think increasingly, and we see that, increasingly the United States is no longer considered to be a mediator. The Palestinians, for sure, cannot continue to do this. Abbas cannot continue to agree to these things, and that's obvious.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip are still reeling from the most recent Israeli onslaught against the coastal territory. Such scenes of destruction are seen throughout Gaza, with many families camping near their flattened homes.
It could take many months before these ruined buildings are rebuilt. Israel's devastating onslaught left scores of Palestinians, including dozens of children, dead. The war was another stark reminder of how brutal the regime can be in dealing with the people it has subjugated for many decades. The Israelis argued during the operation that they were trying to wipe out resistance groups and their capabilities. But that's implausible because the sheer number of civilian casualties and horrific scenes of destruction of residential buildings leave no doubt that the regime committed numerous crimes and violations during its latest war. On Thursday, the United Nations Human Rights Council voted to launch an international investigation into the war. The draft resolution was presented by Pakistan on behalf of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation and the Palestinian delegation to the United Nations. Pakistan's ambassador to the OIC, Khalil Hashmi, who was speaking on behalf of the organization, sharply criticized Israel's supporters. He blasted Israel's allies for shielding the occupier from global accountability and providing arms and ammunition for its widely reported war crimes and crimes of apartheid against the Palestinian people. United Nations Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet had tough words for Israel. She rejected Israeli claims that the destroyed buildings in Gaza were hosting members of the Palestinian resistance groups or used for military purposes. Meanwhile, the UN rights chief also criticized Hamas for firing rockets at Israeli cities, saying it constituted, quote, a clear violation of international humanitarian law. Thursday's announcement of an international investigation into alleged crimes committed during the 11-day war seems to have enraged the Israelis. The regime was quick to reject the decision, saying it would not cooperate with the probe. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas, on the other hand, welcomed the investigation. The United States, which has observer status and no vote at the Geneva Forum, refrained from speaking at the special session. The investigators will have a broad mandate to look into all alleged violations. The probe will cover not just the Gaza Strip, but also the occupied West Bank and the Israeli cities, which came under retaliatory rocket attacks by Palestinian resistance groups. Future findings of the independent investigation are expected to once again mount pressure on the Israeli regime. But will its allies allow any meaningful action against it? The U.S. in particular has been extremely supportive of Tel Aviv. Observers believe this unwavering support leaves no room for the U.S. to want to be a mediator between the Israelis and the Palestinians.
Obviously, for people in Palestine, for many, many countries in the world, the notion of the United States being a mediator is simply a derisory. It's a joke, and nobody believes it. But for internal domestic consumption, that's important. It also is a fig leaf for Europeans, particularly the British, but others, to say, well, the United States is in charge, and we don't have to do anything. But I think increasingly, and we see that, increasingly the United States is no longer considered to be a mediator. The Palestinians, for sure, cannot continue to do this. Abbas cannot continue to agree to these things, and that's obvious.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.